Be gentle, gentle with me. I feel a fragile all this year. Be gentle, gentle with me. Me and the voice. This voice. I counted 10,000 walls around my heart now. Can't see my eyeballs, my walls. Some are made of cardboard and some are made of clay. Some are made of memories of that sad, sad day. Oh, I know every single one of my walls, my walls. Oh, I walk amongst them, in between them, shout from on top of them. I walk amongst them, in between them, shout from on top of my eye. Some hold bones like graveyard stones, like fossils in the sea. Well, some are painted red for mystic me.
Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. And that was Miklik Hadaro's Walls. And yeah, we've got to unpack those barriers that keep us from being our true selves and realizing our immense capacity. So just think about walls. Walls. Do we build them, or does someone build them to keep us from away from ourselves? And we have a wonderful interview this morning with Rodessa Jones. Yes, the Rodessa Jones, our co-artistic director of the critically acclaimed San Francisco performance company Cultural Odyssey. She's an actress, a teacher, a singer, a writer. She's also the founder and director of the Medea Project, Theater for Incarcerated Women. On January 29th this year, San Francisco Mayor Lee presented the 2013 Mayor's Art Award to Rodessa Jones for her lifetime of artistic achievement and enduring commitment to the role of the arts in civic life. Rodessa Jones was selected as an Arts envoy by the United States Department of State Educational and Cultural Affairs Bureau in June and July of 2012, just last year. She received grant support to travel to South Africa to continue her work in collaboration with Urban Voices Festival inside the Naturena Women's Prison in Johannesburg, South Africa. And then she journeyed on to participate in the National Arts Festival in Grahamstown, South Africa. She has received many awards for her work, including a United States Artist Fellowship to support her work in 2007, an honorary doctorate from California College of the Arts, and that's the same year that my daughter received her Bachelor's of Fine Arts, so that was in the year 2004. She also received, Rodessa Jones received, a San Francisco Bay Guardian Goldie Lifetime Achievement Award, an Otto Rene Castillo Award for Political Theater, and a San Francisco Foundation Community Leadership Award. So we are talking about in this particular interview, because we've been so lucky to have Ms. Jones on our show a couple of times. And this particular time, in celebration of National Women's History Month, Rodessa Jones is the artist in residence at Brava Theater. And she's going to perform her new solo work, The Resurrection of She, opening March 28th through April 7th. And it's going to just be so exciting, and you're going to really love this conversation that we had with Ms. Jones just yesterday. And this is our, I just thought, wow, this is International Women's Month, and then International Women's Day is coming up in just a couple of days, and why not just start, kick off our Women's History Month with a conversation with Ms. Jones. She is like, and talking about the resurrection of she, how intriguing and how appropriate. So here is Ms. Jones talking about the resurrection of she, which again opens at Brava Theater in San Francisco, March 28th, and it continues through April 7th. And it's a two-week run, and each evening it's going to be a little bit different, and there are going to be a lot of surprises. So you certainly want to take that journey with Ms. Jones. So I'm speaking to Ms. Rodessa Jones about The Resurrection of She, and it's directed, and the music is by Idris Akinwumi, her longtime collaborator, and Hamilton College is presenting this. Tell me about the Hamilton College presentation. That was the first place it was presented?
Yeah, it was a... We wanted to see if it had legs, just because I was scheduled to be there to do some work in a prison there.
Strangely
enough, that fell apart for them.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't get clearance. You know, San Francisco, California is a very different place for us, even the prisons, although they're large warehousing and it's a money-making factor. But for me, anyways, I cut my tooth in California on working in prisons and in other places, prisons are just hard to get into, you know.
Yeah, I tried. It's really hard. You can't even get in the lobby. You're outside talking to them, and they're saying, no, you can't come in. And that's South Africa, Madagascar, and Senegal.
Yeah, those some of my African friends and associates, they kind of get miffed, but I just end my salutations and everything with them with just pray for Africa, because, it's just so, the deal is going down, and it's always so dark in a lot of ways, and, you know, and it just, South Africa, I was very impressed because of the program that they embraced. I mean, I was surprised because I thought I was going to go and it was going to be the same old, but no, I actually have been working there now for almost a decade. And
I stayed down the street from you. I couldn't afford where you all stay.
Thanks to the the Rockefeller Foundation, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's a nice neighborhood. It doesn't feel like Africa at all. I mean, there's a 7th Street.
Yes. I was just at Brown this past weekend. I did a major creative survival workshop with students at Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a young lady from Kenya, and she was talking about how Africa is looking more and more like that. Wherever there's any affluence, it's like those nice neighborhoods that are all locked down, though. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's like you cannot get, you know, living in those neighborhoods, it's like you got to have a key to do this, you got to have a key to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the poor is pounding at the door, you know, and the rich are getting richer, and they're not, and they don't look like Black Africa, you know,
mm-hmm.
basically. So the guy that owns the spot that we ran, he's a white South African who wears a mask of gentility, and but I've got to know the people who work there, and, you know, and it's still slavery, you know, it's
mm-hmm.
still largely slavery. One of my favorite maids, she quit, you know, I mean, she wanted to be a nurse, and this man was not going to have her giving him hours when she could work, and because she was trying to go back to school and better herself. It was just insane. And I've been very supportive of her, right down to sending money every
mm-hmm.
few months to her and her family because she's trying to find another job. But she did get into school and got some support from some organization, but she lost her job because she was attempting to better herself, you know.
Hmm.
Yeah, he wouldn't let her work there, and because she was calling her own hours. It was pretty amazing. Yeah, just
mm-hmm.
we take so much for granted, even as crazy as it is in this country. We take so much for granted about where you can go, what you can do, how you can dream, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And speaking of dreaming and telling stories, it seems as if, you know, you were born telling stories. You must have been, you know, eating this great produce that your migrant, you know, family members, you know, the Dokinye family, you know, as you were traveling along the East Coast, you know, they were traveling on the East Coast picking vegetables and fruits and telling stories, perhaps?
Yeah, well, you know, the storytelling really was handed down from my grandmother,
mm-hmm.
my mother's mother. You know, early on, even before the migratory legacy started to happen in my family, my grandmother, that's how she took care of all of us. That's how she kept us focused, and she was just a master storyteller, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I knew about Uncle Remus long before Walt Disney, you know. Ver Rabbit,
mm-hmm.
Ver Fox, and then my dad was also a wonderful storyteller in that, you know, he passed on all those, a lot of the stories that Zora Neale Hurston proceeded to capture in her anthological studies, my dad was already telling us these stories about the talking mule and
mm-hmm.
You know, and my father had even been to Eatonville when he was a young man.
Oh, yeah. Did he meet Zora Neale Hurston? Was she still there?
I have a feeling that I have this premise. Maybe it's my own storyteller, but there is a sad story in my family that my mother shared with my brother Bill and I. Very interesting in that Bill was presenting The Last Supper at Uncle Tom's Cabin. This was like back in the late 80s, 90s,
mm-hmm.
and we were all in the limo circling the block trying to find a way to get out. My mom was with us. It was Bill and I. My mother started telling us the story of how my father had killed my Uncle Pat, her older sister's husband. They had been brothers, Lily. They had been so close.
Mm-hmm.
But it was over a woman, a fancy city woman, who would sit on the commissary steps and share stories with these men. And apparently they both fell for this woman. And in my heart of hearts, I think it was Zora Neale Hurston.
Oh, my. Wow. That's cool.
Yeah, that both of these men saw her and heard her and had never been in the presence of such a sparkling, free spirit ever. And my mother said that it was that woman in that red that red tilted hat. And I think that my father and my uncle both fancied, they were both handsome, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember a lot about my Uncle Pat. I remember a picture of him, but my father was very handsome, and I think that they just got a kick out of her presence, and she's probably a great flirt. And my Uncle Pat came around the morning that she left town, and he had a gun, and he wanted to kill my dad. And my mother and my aunt, to this day, they don't know really what happened.
Hmm.
But I think it was either my father got to spend a little more time with her than my uncle, and at any rate, my father killed him first.
Wow.
Yeah, it was just this blazing, crazy battle between these two black men over something that was not spoken. And my mother said, I think it had to do with that fancy city woman that got, because she got, during the Hurston, got on a train the same morning, and I guess all the women were a tad relieved, I'm saying, this woman did, and left town, and then my uncle came over to kill my father. And my father apparently was ready for him, you know, shot him first when he came up on the property, you know.
Wow, that sounds like something out of a Zora Neale Hurston tale.
Yes, really.
So, amazing.
Yeah, so that's my Zora Neale Hurston story, and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, why not? Why not? So, you are bringing the Resurrection of She to San Francisco at the end of this month. I believe it's the 28th.
Yes.
And it's going to be at Brava Theater for, I don't know, is it a week or week?
2 weeks.
2 weeks, yeah, so people can go back and see it again. And there's a subtitle to this piece, The Resurrection of She, and a subtitle, The Rodessa Jones Story. It's like, oh, wow, it's The Rodessa Jones Story, like part one or what? Because part three or four, because we've seen a lot of your stories.
it's a return to some old material, and that with my work in Africa and my work in San Francisco with the Medea Project methodologies, it has been an incredible eye-opener, looking at how the lives of South African women and the lives of incarcerated women, marginalized women, I guess I should say, in America are so alike.
Mm-hmm.
And on one level, I marvel at whatever has brought me to this place in time where I can mine stories from women. Women will share just about anything with me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided in making The Resurrection of She that I was going to go back and examine my methodologies and could I do the same thing openly to myself.
Oh.
To craft my own journey, you know, as a woman, as an artist, as an African American woman, as a mother, as a grandmother, you know, could I chart my own course? And so that's what The Resurrection of She basically is. It's like looking at the way our lives are really like an onion, you know, that we keep peeling back layer after layer after layer.
Mm-hmm.
And how many times have you died? When did you die? You know, I mean, I had a baby at 16 by a boy that I was so innocent. He said he loved me and held my hand in the moonlight and sang the Beatles, When I Get Older, Losing My Hair, When I'm 64. And then everything that happened out of that betrayal in a lot of ways. I mean, and then, of course, when I came up pregnant, it was my fault. You know, obviously I wasn't a nice girl.
Mm-hmm.
He turned into somebody I did not recognize. And I had to move on. I had to live on. But you have to let go of who you were. And that is a death in itself, you know. And then he just died. He just died just after Christmas, my daughter's father.
Mm-hmm.
And that is another death. I went to his memorial because my daughter is in Dubai. And she said, Mom, I know you might not want to do this, but would you go? And I said, of course I would. You know, of course I'd go. And in going, well, first of all, fast rewind, I went to see him with my daughter and granddaughter in hospice before he died.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at him, and I realized that I did not know the man, the 60-some-year-old man who was ranting and raving in that bed. I knew the boy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought more about, well, what happened to the girl, myself?
Mm-hmm.
What happens to her? And I think that we can all agree that every time you see a grandchild and you go back and you see that grandchild again, there's a new person there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I've never lived that close to my daughter and granddaughter. So every time I'd see my granddaughter, she'd be somebody else.
Right.
And they go on in time. You know, we all go on in time. So thus the resurrection. And the person that I have arrived to be, that I really love, I'm proud of, I respect, that is hopefully the crowning jewel of this performance.
Hmm.
It's who I present myself as at the end of the evening. You know, who I have grown up to be.
Uh-huh.
And it's back to women's lives and works. How do we bury dead dreams, you know, so that we can go on? How do we bury our dead and still go on? I mean, I have this running joke, which I try out on people. I'll just say, well, you know, it's dying time.
Hmm.
It's dying time in America. It's dying time in my life. And people are like, oh, that's so morbid. But it's I'm 64. And I have become a part of that group, as my mother used to describe, the group that's coming from the cemetery, just having buried someone, and arrive at the house to find that someone else has died, and
mm-hmm.
we must go back to the cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one of those wailing women now. You know, when I was a child, you know, I heard about it because we lived very openly, but it didn't affect me the same way because youth. You're so resilient, and death doesn't make any sense yet, you know. And now it's like to have buried my mother and father. They're both gone, you
mm-hmm.
know. To now to have married my daughter's father, you know. To I didn't bury him, but I watched him. He died and left me the love of my life, the man that I think pulled all of my womanism and my sexuality and my sensuality together, my witch's craft, you know. He loved my food. We used to have such a lovely time together. And with him, I had arrived at this place where I don't have to be married. This is enough.
Mm-hmm.
This is enough, this man's love, this man's affection. And he was Mexican. You know, he was Mexican with no papers,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then he died of bone cancer last January.
Oh, and, like last year?
Yes. None of us. Well, he died in San Diego.
Mm.
But all of a sudden immigration was lying next to me in my bed, the whole plight of it. And I think he died of literally a broken heart and a broken spirit because he was such a good man, so sweet and elegant, and but he had lived in this country for 25 years with no status.
Mm.
And he had raised a daughter, a very fabulous daughter, poet,
mm-hmm.
and he was so proud, and he was the man that came for me and said, look, you know, are we going to make this something? You know, I need to know what your intentions are. It was just so fabulous. It was
mm-hmm.
like, you know, because he said, because I'm ready to go home now. This was a year or so before he died.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you know, my kid's going to be okay. I can't live in this country like this anymore. And then I was teaching at the Art Institute about 5-6 months ago, and a young Mexican woman said, you know, I was telling them a story somewhat like I'm telling you,
mm-hmm.
and she said, well, you know, studies have shown that Mexican men, they die 20 years before their time.
Mm-hmm.
The ones who come here and try to make it right, they work harder than, my friend used to say, you know, Mexican people are maligned. He said, but, you know, we work harder than anybody. We work harder than the Bolivians. We work harder than the Colombians. We work harder than the Salvadorians. We work because we like working, and it all makes sense being here, because other than that, he says nobody wants to be in America. You know, there's just no money in our own country. And he loved Mexico. He taught me so much about the art, the culture of Mexico, and he would dream about us going there and hanging out. And and he told me that I was his Khalifa.
Nice.
He talked about the black Amazons in Mexico, you know. And then he died. Boom. Like, it caught everybody off guard. And so I've had to, then I've got Aretha. I put on Aretha's song, you know. I can't help it now that he's gone. I've got my own life. I've got to live on, you know. And again, the resurrection. Who is that woman now, you know? Going to my daughter's father's memorial after the big celebration in San Francisco, and I'm the mayor's artist of the year. And I go to this memorial service, and these people are like, now, who are you again? And I really felt like a ghost. I just felt like a ghost.
Well, that's, you know, when you're talking about, these different selves and dying, you know, to these different yous, you know, when that is time to move or step into another room. And I was just thinking about Ruth Brown, the great artist, who talked about when she was, you know, sort of getting up there in age, that she was in God's waiting room.
Wow.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, I thought about that. And then I was wondering, as you were talking about, your grandchildren, your granddaughter, and how every time you see her, she's another person, because you don't see her, that process of her getting older and growing. Mm-hmm. You just see her at these different stages. And I was wondering, how many selves have you had to let go, and can you ever retrieve, are they sort of like, you know how when you delete things, sometimes it says, gone forever, but then we know there's no such thing as that for real.
Yeah.
Online, but it says that, so it means that I can't access it anymore. But when you move on, are you really moving on? Is the door like shut, locked, gone? Like, it's never, you can't, or can you actually go back and get some of those persons just in case you weren't really finished with her?
Well, therein lies the performance material for this show. I don't know. I'm exploring, and I am perusing to see. You know, I think I heard a poet say, she said, when you are downhearted and you're having a terrible day, remember when you were five. Try to revisit being five. And how simple the world is, supposedly. Now, I've lived, and the work I've done has shown that a lot of five-year-old children are already looking at you with ancient eyes. But largely, I think what she meant was that before life hurt, I like nine. In the show, I am I'm gathering stories of when we were nine. As a nine-year-old girl, I read another article in More magazine, and I invite you to send me a story that happened to you at nine as well.
Okay.
And this writer is talking about her love of horses and how she had always dreamed that she would go to Uruguay and learn to ride in a certain Spanish style. And she said for some reason it all came together for her at nine. That she knew that's what she wanted to do. And as she has studied the lives of other women and have gathered stories about being nine, she's come to this conclusion that at nine you're fully formed. You know, I mean, you have your opinion, you have your psychic, spiritual energy. And I remember with my dad, I just remember telling my father I was going to be a great ballerina. And I was going to have a pink jet, and I was going to live in Russia. And I can remember just being so clear about it all. And I remember my father, he listened to me. He didn't tell me it wasn't going to happen. he said, is that right? And I said, yeah, and I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And my dad would just be so engrossed, I think, in me. It's like, who is this? You know, I mean, and I was just so basking in my father's eyes. I was so sure of my 9-year-old self mm-hmm. and where I was going. And now, of course, life knocks you over. And if you're not tended to and taken care of, if there's enough money to sort of protect you from the vestiges of their world, of course, by the time 9 more years, you're 18. And at 18, I had a 2-year-old daughter. You know,
mm-hmm.
So I'm gathering these stories, and I'm working to coagulate these stories so that every night I'll read a different one.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah, in the performance.
Oh, so we have to come to all your performances to get it all?
That's right.
Oh my goodness!
Oh, it's wonderful, and I've gathered some stories by highly profiled people from my yoga class, architects,
mm-hmm.
so, surgeons, and they're these stories that largely are secrets. You see,
mm-hmm.
they're things that have happened to people that they never spoke about, which for me again is the very very heart of the Medea Project.
Yeah,
is that it is where we have to lay it down. Lay it down. It's not your business anymore. It's somebody else's dirty garbage. So you
mm-hmm.
can move on, you know. To answer your question about can we retrieve certain things, I think certain things we don't want to. I think that we're so angry. We get
mm-hmm.
so angry at the world that we're like a mad woman in a dank, dark place who sits there tearing apart the fabric of her life because it feels real. You know, so much stuff will have happened that
mm-hmm.
it feels real, that this is where I live, this is who I am, get over it,
mm-hmm.
you know. And the only person that we're hurting is ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And in my family, there's several women that I have that their lives were like that, with alcohol, just this inability to face the future. So one of my relatives just kind of lives in this rarefied, wide-eyed air of make-believe, and she's like in her late 60s too.
Mm-hmm.
And growing up, I saw these women, and there was something in me that said, no, I'm not going out like that. I'm not. I would rather be the first one to let the world know that this happened to me,
mm-hmm.
that this hurt me, because I learned early that I wasn't alone. We're back to the 9-year-old stories. There are women, nobody's ever asked them anything about anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then here comes Rodessa Jones, big broad smile, talking about my work. And then in light of the award ceremony, a lot of people who thought they knew me had no idea about the work I did. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's a lot of people that, you know, I just...
You're famous. I don't know how anyone could not know.
Well, you know, amongst my people, my dear.
I mean, you're such a celebrity. I'm like, you know, like in a great way, you know?
Yeah, and I had a sister tell me, it was about 3 years ago at a Christmas party Renee Walker's house, one of my costume designers, and
mm-hmm.
this lady just found me and kind of cornered me and thanked me for never leaving.
Mm-hmm.
Never leaving us. She said, thank you for never leaving us. For you could have gone to Hollywood, she
mm-hmm.
said. You're pretty enough to be this. You're pretty enough to be that. But you decided to stay here and be with us, work with us, which was so moving. It was
mm-hmm.
very profound. I'm like, oh, my God, show me the door. I'd still like to drive for Hollywood. But the work has been so rich.
Mm-hmm.
My work with women, the gift of my own production company, Idris Akamore, where I can make my work.
Mm-hmm.
It belongs to me. You know, I mean, I tried offhandedly to do the pilot season in Los Angeles and all this kind of stuff. But no, I just, you know, it wasn't as interesting as my own story and the stories of women around me. you know, mm-hmm. the stories that nobody was telling or talking about. And the rewards have been nice, you know, that and it's meaningful work, you know. I mean, I would love to be driving a Duesenberg now. I mean, that's one of my, you know, and having a beautiful house in the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe something, it won't be as big and lavish as my fantasies. But at any rate, that's probably coming as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like if I was to drop in this spot, that I've done some good work. And even as you say, you're famous, you know, it's for whatever that means. I have people at my gym, they'll say, well, do you do autographs? And I say, well, not really. I said, you know, I don't really do autographs. And I do autographs for young people who might think they know me, but
mm-hmm.
and this lady was a little miffed. She walked off just a little miffed that I would sign the newspaper article, and it was just like, you know, it just kind of caught me off guard. Like, no, you know, I'm not going to burden that either. That, oh, look at me. But then again, the other side of it is that reading the AARP magazine, it says, you know, start collecting signatures from people before they're famous. So
mm-hmm.
maybe I didn't do the lady a service to have maybe saying, no, I didn't help her investment, future investments or whatever. But, yeah.
I was thinking about, I've got a couple of things I was writing as you were talking, and wrote down some words like audacity and authenticity and inheritance and legacy, and then choices. And then I was looking at just juxtaposing the Madea Project Theater for Incarcerated Women, and then Madea, the character, that woman was locked up,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then, you know, through the work that you do with your company, the Madea Project, which is one of the programs of, you know, Culture Odyssey,
mm-hmm.
You free people, and you do it through myth making, and you know, sort of remaking or retelling these stories that are a part of our psyche as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I'm trying to stamp out shame and stigma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it is any way you look at it, if you can get up off the floor and wash your wounds, you're standing, and it's a great life. You know, and I'm not talking in terms of how many dresses you own, or how rich the man is that you have, or the woman is that you have, but that you've lived to look back at the journey, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for younger people, they need that. They need somebody to say, look, you know, you'll get through this. You know, I mean, it's Shawn Reynolds who. She was one of the first people to utter to me, you know, when my mom died. She says, well, you know, you cry because there's nothing else to do. Then you got to stop crying, and then what are you going to do? And I think that that's in part is what I'm saying. And then I saw this group in L.A. many years ago, a woman's group, and they had this wonderful moment in the show. It was a physical sound and movement thing, but it was like, if I fall, will you catch me?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's been very much a part of my own work, you know, trying to retrieve sisters who are worth saving, you know. And also they need to know that they have a right to a life, that a life is not for special people. All of us came here with reason, you know, with reason and intention, you know. Sometimes for, you know, sometimes for maybe 5 years, sometimes for 100 years. I have very, very wealthy friends who were hippies with me, and we all read Edgar Cayce, you know, we all studied Seth, and we Gurdjieff, and they grew up to either marry into lots of money or make lots of money. And now they're saying they're going to live to be 200 years old,
mm-hmm.
you know, which I don't necessarily know if I want to be around that long, because I like physically being able to move about. And we don't know what to do with the aged and the elderly in our culture. And that unsettles me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know if I want to be around to have to face that stuff, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Safety. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I was wondering, a couple of more questions. I was just remembering how wonderful you were as curator of the San Francisco International Arts Festival. What year was that? And you just had all this great art from the Pan-African Diaspora. Oh, 2005, okay. That was a wonderful, wonderful showcase.
And God bless Andrew Wood.
Yeah, Andrew's wonderful.
He sent me to Bali, to the Mali. In
Yeah, and you talk about, you know, the young people and the older people and, yeah, and the art and just the landscape and the people that you met.
Yes. Well, people make up everything, you know. If the people aren't there, it doesn't matter. I mean, I found this out for true about Hawaii. Hawaii is pretty, but there's areas of it that's been manicured to death. And the people can be a tad soulless, you know. And this was on my own account, and it was very disappointing to me, you know. Or race matters, where people don't want to be, Hawaiian people, some of them don't want to be confused with being black. And that hit me, that kind of hit me hard when I was there for the first time, wandering around that paradise, and came upon a couple of instances where some white person, a ticket taker, gatekeeper, assumed that I was with whomever was in front of me or whatever, and just watching the brown people and their response to no, I'm Hawaiian. I remember one woman and her daughter, we're Hawaiian, and which meant we're not black. You know, so it's like, you know. And I go to Jamaica, and I still can find pockets of musical humanity, and the people are being kind of starved out of their freedoms, and that everything is being sold by the government, but you know, God bless the music of Marley and reggae and people that look like me. And when they got a moment to be free, you know, when they can come up out of their strife and stress, it's such a lovely place to be, you know, with that backdrop of the ocean and all that stuff going on, you know. Of course, yeah, as a man, you have to say, look, I'm not the one. I'm not in the market for a Jamaican boyfriend, or did that a long time ago, and excuse me, coming through, but largely it's wonderful, glass of rum, a hit of ganja in the ocean, I'm there.
Yeah, it was really interesting, you know, these places that don't want to honor their African heritage, I mean, you know, Hawaii, you know, I mean, their last queen was black, straight up, I mean, the sister looks like a sister. And then you think about Mexico, you know, I mean, we're all over Mexico, and the last governor was black. So it's like, I mean, you know, like, we should be uniting, not separating.
That's so much, one of the women in the Medea Project, Angie. One of the reasons I fell in love with Angie was that she came into the process when the Rockefeller Foundation had funded Cultural Odyssey to go into the jails and explore race, culture, and religion. And so here's this little white girl from Idaho who, one could say, the first black person I met, I was 12 years old when I first met a black person. And then the whole question of if there was a pill to take that would make you any other race, would black be a choice? And she said, well, only if I could take it for a shorter period of time. And, of course, people are like, well, you know, people are getting very upset. You know, later for you and I. And then I said, no, let her finish. She said, look around you. The world is so hard on black people. She said, black people can dance, black people cook, black people are funny. It's a lot of fun, but the world can be so hard on people of African descent, I think is what she meant. And here she was, a little blonde girl from Idaho, you know. And I just thought it was an incredibly astute observation to make, you know, that you're absolutely right. So wherever I go, I still try to work to create a bond with all of us, you know, I mean, with everybody. Last night on the plane coming home, I'm talking to a gentleman who was from, white man, I think he was from Marin.
Oh, okay.
He had just come back with his son who was, he had taken his son to visit Brown and another college there. And we're chatting it up in the back, I think, and he just really enjoyed me being so open and funny, you know, because by the time he got back there, I was looking at the two bathrooms, and it seemed like people had been in the bathrooms forever. He said, but I'm just watching the doors, and he thought that was hysterically funny. And we start talking, up comes this white lady, and I said to her, I said, well, you know, I'm watching the doors, and he's, and we're celebrating our children and our parenting. And she looked at me and she said, well, when I walked back, I saw you. I thought you'd be back here cooking us something good to eat.
What?
Yes. I see, I'm not quick enough then. It's like, huh? He looked at her like, what are you talking about? And she thought she was being, a part of the conversation. You know, if I had been as quick as my friend Sean had cussed out and called her several different kinds of bees and, you know, and invited her to my backside, she probably would have went running back to her seat crying and saying that, why are black people so hostile? You know? You know? It's always a question when you're in the wrong, when some white folks come up and get off your face and they're totally off the chain, you tell them, then you are hostile. But it was just like, I was stunned. Like, what?
Mm-hmm.
And she totally meant it.
Mm-hmm.
And she thought she was paying me some compliment, I think. You know, I mean, it was just really odd.
That's very odd.
Yeah, and at the same time, the big red stewardess came back, and she's the guy is saying, we've been waiting for bathrooms, and she says, I don't think there's anybody in this one. And he and I had been back there talking, and apparently whoever left had not, like, left the door open or, you know, and it was just, like, more irresponsibility and inhumanity and a lack of connection with each other, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And here's this lady standing there, you know, hoping that I'm going to entertain her now. And the guy said, no, you go first, he said to me. And I just went right into the bathroom and back to my seat. It was like, you know, just this kind of ignorance. It's just like ignorance, boldness, you know, and, at the same time, it's all you can do is hope that somebody will relieve her of some of that stupidity, you know. It's like, but it wasn't me last night. I was just like, what the hell?
Yeah. Well, hopefully she will see your picture in a newspaper and come to see the resurrection of she and like, oh my God.
Yeah. Well, I'm reaching out to everybody. I want everybody who thinks they know me to please come out, you know, and see my latest work.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, it's timing as long as it has been.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I wonder sometimes, Rodessa, my work can be so prophetic. What am I really saying? Am I saying goodbye?
Oh, heck no. No, you're not saying goodbye. No, not at all. I remember that the cabaret-style piece you did where it was all red and was about hot flashes. That was
That's one of my favorite pieces in the whole world.
That was really fun. And I want to mention, I know you brought your crown back from South Africa, and Mary McCabe's birthday just passed on the 4th, which was yesterday.
And that's my baby sister's birthday.
Oh,
wonderful.
Yeah, she would have been 81.
Oh, my God, what a goddess, you know, what a goddess. I mean, it's like, and the whole idea to die in the midst of performance.
Mm-hmm.
What a way to go.
Oh,
know?
Yeah.
Her musician says she walked off stage.
Mm-hmm.
And she wasn't it wasn't time. They hadn't gotten through all the songs, but she kind of walked off stage and apparently collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
And but what a way to go with the audience still calling and screaming for you.
Mm. Yeah, that sound following you in your ascension.
Mm.
Oh, that is awesome.
Yeah, that's, you know, and it, when I hear that story from people, it's just amazing, as well as getting my first crown in the marketplace. And, and you know, me and I'm Curious George, you know, so I'm looking at all these beautiful African women in these gorgeous, strange hats, these headpieces. And I'm asking, what's going on? What is this?
Mm-hmm.
And they told me, they said, Mama Africa has ascended. And of course, I love the idea that Mary Makeba was Mother Africa. That was her name with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, you must have one. And so they gave me my first one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one that I'm wearing on my Facebook with George, with Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But no. And, you know, and I saw Winnie Mandela
mm-hmm.
when I was in Soweto, two or three trips back.
Mm-hmm.
That was another queen.
Yes, she is.
Yeah, I asked this, my guide was taking me to the radio station television station in Soweto for an interview.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I know Winnie Mandela has a tea house around here. And he said, oh, yes. I said, you think we'll see her? He said, well, you never know. So we're walking down to get some coffee before the interview. And there she is, and this huge black BMW,
mm-hmm.
huge car. And there's two very large, handsome black men outside the car, and she's sitting in the back seat on her cell phone, but just light, you know, the light is just emanating from her. It was amazing.
Mm.
And I just stood there, and she looked up and looked at me. And I looked at her, and I just, like, saluted her, and mm-hmm. she nodded her head,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I wrote to my late sister-in-law, Linda. I said, well, you know, I still think, how do you salute a queen?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do you say when she's still so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's just beautiful. But thank you for reminding me of these moments, because I got to pull up that piece, because I'd like to just call upon Winnie Mandela.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. And so my last question and comment is if you could talk about the poetry of your life and how art, you know, sort of keeps us human.
Mm. Well, I think it all begins with love.
Mm-hmm.
And love is its own reward. You know, it's if you love, the universe will love you back. Now, don't be blindly and stupidly giving over all of your goods to whomever comes along, but keep an open heart and an open mind. And at the same time, as my brother Bill T. Jones often reminds me, of the world of ideas. What can you do with love? What is another way to approach love? You know, and that's what we artists are privy to. Taking ideas and wrapping them around old forms, you know, and the idea of love, it softens everybody. It keeps us all human, you know. And I think woman as well. My trainer, Charles, who was from Marseille, Charles told me years ago, I haven't seen him in a while, he said, I never can understand why a man would want to lay his hands on a woman in an abusive, violent way, because he said, look at a woman. A woman is shaped like a heart.
Hmm.
You know, he said that on some level, you look at the body of a woman versus the body of a man. And it's right down to our sexual center. It doesn't hang out, you know. It's almost as though the line drawing ends there in the heart.
Hmm.
And he says that women are all shaped like hearts.
Wow.
And I try to, as an artist, I try to re-enter old conversations, old ideas, but with the idea of pulling in another way of looking at it. And I've been lucky that people will go with me.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's because people want to believe in something. You know, right now I'm struggling with costume because I feel like I've got to be fabulous.
Mm,
people
of course. Yes.
Will come to see Rodessa be fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, or naked, which I'm not doing anymore, but I used to be gloriously naked back in the early days, you know, ferociously naked, you know, when I did my early stuff. I was an artist's model.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the art teacher at San Jose State saying to his group when I was very young, I was modeling, he said, if you can't draw this body, you should put down your pencils and your papers and your paints. this body is a direct descendant of God and all of God's mercy and glory and beauty. And I remember that thinking. I was all embarrassed, like, oh, my God. But it was a blessing for me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother used to say, on a note just about this art making, my mother said when she finally saw a piece of my performance, and I was at Berkeley, and my mother had often looked at me, but then as mothers and daughters and sons, my brother Bill is such a bright light, you know, my mother sort of knew I was doing something over there. But she came to see, I did a performance for sex and gender, culture and gender at Berkeley. I think it was, I can't remember, was it Opal or Disa, was one of her classes.
Uh-huh.
And my mom came back, so I did a piece about the four generations of women in my family, the blue stories.
Mm.
And I did it, my mother was there in the audience, and I was very nervous, because I'm always spilling, family secrets and opening closets and all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh my God, she's not coming back, oh my, she's mad, blah, 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 blah. But she finally came back, and everybody had gone, and I was putting my makeup away, and she came back, and she stood there in the doorway, and I remember her wonderful hands. She had these amazingly beautiful hands, and they were so powerful. She just stood there and looked at me, and she said, "Now I know what you do.
Mm-hmm.
You tell your story as a way to lift the people up." And that was my mother's blessing, and I passed that on, that in the name of art and saving the human family, I think it's about sharing stories. I tell you my story. I'll tell my story if you can tell me yours.
And, mm-hmm.
You know, and once you hear somebody's story, you definitely can't help but see them differently. So that's what I do in the name of saving the tribe.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for all that you do. And, gosh, the resurrection of She is going to be so phenomenal. March 28th through April 7th, and I was looking at the dates, and it passes through the season of, what's it called? The season of peace, you know, that starts in January, and it goes through Martin King's assassination, and it travels through Gandhi's life, Kennedy's life, Malcolm's life, and then so it's like 3 days past it. And from what you say, we definitely need to catch you more than once. So
yes.
People shouldn't wait till the last week. And, you know, the last days of the last week, because you'd probably be selling out, because Bravo's not huge.
And also, you know, what happens to me all the time is somebody will say, you know, I saw that show, and I really wanted to come back again, or I wanted to ask you, like, what you meant, you know. And and depending on how I feel or how the audience feels, I may have a few talkbacks.
Oh, so, wow, that'd be so great.
Yeah.
So there's the element of surprise there too. I mean, we might get more than just sitting in the audience. We'll be able to like talk to you, and afterwards see you walk out of the dressing room and get your autograph. And
yeah, all those things may very well happen. And at the same time, the part of the resurrection is that I really want to be able to say no.
Right. Yes.
You know,
of course.
It's like good night. Like Katharine Hepburn said, some lady asked for an autograph. Katharine Hepburn, who's one of my heroes.
Mm-hmm.
Katharine Hepburn. This woman said. Katharine Hepburn said, "Oh no. I'm really tired." And this lady said, "Well, we made you who you are." And she said, "Like hell you did." So I'll end on that note.
Okay. Thank you, Rodessa. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for the wonderful conversation. I look forward to seeing you in the resurrection of She.
Yeah, it's going to be a great evening.
There will be. Everything you do is great.
Thank you.
All right, you take good care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
So we were speaking to Rodessa Jones about her latest work, opening at Brava Theater on March 28th, and it continues for 2 weeks through April 7th, The Resurrection of She, directed and music by Idris Akamor. Brava Theater is located at 2781 24th Street in San Francisco, and the phone number there is 415-641-7657, 415-671-7657. 5-7. And I'm trying to think, what is their, let me look and see if I can find their website. Their website is brava.org, so you can get your tickets online, and I certainly recommend that because Brava does sell out. And culturaodyssey.org is also where you can find out more about the resurrection of she. And while I'm making announcements, I wanted to make a couple of more. I wanted to let folks know that the University Dance Theater is presenting its student choreographer showcase on Thursday through Saturday, March 7th through 9th, 8 o'clock in the evening at the, what theater is that? I am looking and I'm not seeing what theater. So you just have to visit creativestate.sfsu.edu. Which stands for San Francisco State University. It's at the University Dance Theater, right in front of my face. And some of these wonderful choreographers actually performed and choreographed work at Black Choreographers Here and Now Festival Here and Now, Black Choreographers Festival Here and Now, which closed, I believe it was February 24th, that last Saturday, that last Sunday in February, and the program was called Next Wave, or New Wave. I'm just fumbling everything here right at the moment. I think it was called New Wave, and New Wave showcased up and coming choreographers. You know, choreographers that we can still afford to go see because they're not blowing up all over the place. And then the theaters that are not necessarily affordable for everyone. So saw quite a few wonderful performances, and two of the choreographer dancers are actually presenting work in the university, San Francisco State University's Celebrate Dance. So I'm really excited about that, catching that. And again, that starts on Thursday, which is tomorrow, March 7th, and it continues through Saturday the 9th. And Mumia, the film about Mumia, is actually going to be opening at the New Parkway Theater on Friday, which is, Friday is the, what is the date? Women's International Women's History Month, International Women's Day, which is the 8th. How could I forget that date? So that's going to be exciting, and so you can look for an interview. I think I might do a special broadcast on Thursday, so stay tuned. I'm not certain if that's happening for sure, but just in case. But, trying to set up an interview with the director, and I'm sure that's going to happen. So that might be on Friday's show. There's so much going to be on Friday's show, so you definitely want to tune in to the International Women's Day special. Gonna have a lot of great folks popping in. Alrighty, so we're going to play a little bit of Ruthie Foster and a little bit of Renee Marie, and might call it a day and let the resurrection of she and that wonderful interview with Redessa Jones be what you carry into the rest of your day and the rest of your week until you pop in again to Wanda's Picks. Peace and blessings.
Tell
just my mind.